Chapter 7, Finding Him. You may wonder at what point I actually felt that I had become so immersed in faith that it was me and I was it, when it had all sort of clicked together. And the answer is, I don't know. To me, I think finally coming to believe in Christ is like getting well after an illness. You cannot say at exactly what point the recovery commenced, but you know when you're getting better and stronger, and at the end, you know when you've recovered. But here is something I began to feel after I had faith. It was the unexpected joy of living things. At some point, living things began to seem very precious to me, and I wanted to pet them and hug them, everything from babies and dogs to lizards, whatever. For me, the great fruit of belief is joy. There is a God, there is a purpose, there is a meaning to things. There are realities we cannot guess at. There is a big peace, and you are part of it. God is good. Near Him is where you want to be. There is something called everlasting happiness, and St. Paul, a fiercely imperfect man who was a great man, was granted visions of it. And that great user of words was floored. He said, "No one can imagine how wonderful it is. The human imagination cannot encompass it." Or, as Dante wrote, "The beauty I beheld transcendeth measure, not only past our reach, but surely I believe that only He who made it enjoyeth it complete." In 1996, a friend wrote and asked me how I would answer the question, "How do you find God?" I thought about it a while, and I sent this reply. I said, "Finding God is not hard because He wants to be found, but keeping God can be pretty hard. He wants to be kept, of course, but for most of us, finding Him and keeping Him is the difference between falling in love and staying in love. The latter often involves a decision that is held to." Here is a path to finding Him and keeping Him. 1, get yourself in trouble. Let life make you miserable. This shouldn't be hard. A bad night in a bad inn. That is how Teresa of Avila is said to have described our earthly life, and every smart, happy, well-adjusted adult you know would probably admit that that's just about right. So, get low, gnash your teeth, cry aloud, rend your garments, refuse to get out of bed. Be in crisis. Trouble is good. Man's extremity is God's opportunity, as American evangelicals say. But before they said it, Henry VIII's first wife, Catherine of Aragon, said it. She said, "None get to God but through trouble." For most of us, the world, with all its dazzlement, has to turn pretty flat and pretty dry before we want God. But God seems to turn it flat just at the moment when He knows you're ready. So embrace your ill fortune as a blessing. If you haven't been blessed with a crisis, I'm not sure what to tell you beyond, I guess, pray for one. You may have to just hang around enjoying the dazzlements until He's ready to lower the boom, but He will, in His time and not yours, if that's the only way He can get your attention, because not only are you looking for Him, but He's been looking for you. 2, once you're so low you're actually on your knees, review the situation. You could start by admitting what you've long sensed and avoided knowing, that many of the joys and delights of the world are fleeting or fraudulent, and even though those who know you best would never think this, perhaps you happen to have noticed lately that you have a rather black heart. Don't let this be demoralizing. Everyone has a black heart. As a very brilliant and agnostic publisher recently remarked to me in a conversation about why wars happen, he said, "Because there's something wrong with us." Well, there is. And it's inspiring how much good people actually do, considering who and what we are. 3, you're miserable and convicted, and you're still on your knees. Address the God whose existence you doubt. Ask for His help. Ask for His forgiveness. Ask for His mercy. Ask for His attention. Ask to know Him. Or ask a saint to get you to Him. All saints have had dark nights. Evangelical Protestants sometimes use words like these, "Lord, this hasn't worked with me being in charge, so I give my life to You. I believe in You. Help me to believe in You. I ask You to be in charge of my life." I think these are great words. They are not a prescription for passivity. They are an acknowledgement of reality and a pledge of obedience, which can be quite arduous. Belief ain't for sissies. One evangelical friend of mine uses the image of a throne. Either God is on the throne of your life or you are. You don't belong on it. He's the king. You're the servant. He's the father. You're his child. Let him sit on the throne. Every time you and your pride and stupidity try to claw your way back into control, remember the throne and offer the seat to the gentleman who is older and wiser than you. 4. Pray. A priest to whom I'd gone once for guidance told me that prayer is just conversation with your Father in heaven, and like any good conversation with an intimate, it should be honest and trusting and wholly uncensored. You can tell him anything, what kind of day you had, a triumph you had, a temptation, something that's nagging at you, something that worries you, something you're angry about. Ask his blessing for an endeavor. Give thanks. Share frustration. Prayer, in my experience, is hard. It's easier to think about than it is to do. In one way, I happen to pray a lot all day in a continuous conversation. But concentrated prayer is hard. People who know tell me to make time in the morning or the evening, a half hour or so, an hour, 45 minutes, to read the Bible and engage in sustained and concentrated prayer. I know they are right. I'll tell you something I started to do a few years ago that is connected to this and that has made an enormous difference to me. I started reading the New Testament and asking God that I be allowed to know that what I was reading actually happened, that it was all true. During this time, the Acts of the Apostles came alive for me, and after that, a lot of other things did too. 5. Get yourself some friends who will support you and help you. Go to church, find out if there's someone there, a priest or a layperson, who helps converts. Because if you're looking for God, you're having a conversion experience. If your local priest is busy, and chances are he is, find out what's available to believers at the church. Daily prayer meetings, for instance, anything like that, and go. Talk to people. Ask about retreats. 2 or 3 days away, usually in a religious setting, with people who want to enliven their spiritual life. It's, in my experience, hard to go on a retreat, and yet I have never heard anyone regretting it. I've never heard a person say, "Geez, I wish I hadn't gone on that retreat." Nobody wants to go. You go. You don't want to leave. 6. See if you can find and get into a Bible study group to learn more about what it is you believe in, or try to get into a prayer group. 7. Read for knowledge and to enliven the spirit. Books that were important to me: Thomas Merton's memoir of his conversion, The Seven-Story Mountain; Saints for Sinners by Alan Gugier; To Know Christ Jesus by Frank Sheed; and My Utmost for His Highest, the book of Daily Prayers by Oswald Chambers. In fact, to me, just about any evangelical Protestant book is good. They are wonderful for their personal sense of redemption and their excitement about Christ. My advice would be, don't fuss with doctrinal complexities if you're sophisticated enough to spot them, which I was not always. Doctrinal disputes are not your problem right now, and God will heal them all in the end. So I would say, don't worry about them. The issue becomes the icon. That's what the chaplain of the U.S. Senate once told me. He meant, love Jesus, leave the commentary to others. 8. If you never get very excited by your conversion but just plod through, good for you. You'll get your joys. If you start out with excitement and it kind of flattens and lessens with time, and it probably will, pray for ardor. Ask for your old thirst. Keep plugging. It's the most important thing in your life. And remember, every time you fall or fall away, ask for help. You'll get it. 9. Watch John Paul. He seems to say something every day about belief. It's as if he wants to tell us something before he leaves. After the Pope came to America and I said the rosary with him, with all of my friends in St. Patrick's, I longed to meet him personally. I wanted to go to Rome and simply touch his hand. And finally I did. It was late June in the year 2000. So let me tell you what it was like to meet him. It was like what the actor Richard Burton said of Winston Churchill. He said the force of his presence was like a blow to the heart. I was to be in Rome to make a speech to a professional group about the upcoming American elections. After I was invited to participate, I called a woman I'd recently met who worked in the office of Cardinal O'Connor in New York. I asked if she knew if the Pope would be in Rome in June, and if so, how did one get into one of those big public audiences? She told me, yes, the Pope was scheduled to be in Rome, the Cardinal himself would be there too, and she'd ask him to give me some help. And indeed, he did help me. I was in Rome for 5 days, and each day I hoped a call would come, and each day it did not. The day before I was to leave, on a Thursday morning, the phone rang in my hotel room, and a woman with an Italian accent and perfect English told me that the next morning I would see the Pope. She said, "Go to the bronze doors of the Vatican and wait." That's what I wrote in my notes. No address, just big bronze doors, Vatican. The next morning at sunrise, already awake and showered and having found somewhere a little scarf to wear on my head, I hailed a taxi and I said with no confidence in English, "The big bronze doors of the Vatican, please." And to my surprise, the driver said, "Okay," as if people often ask for that destination. And he took me on a 10-minute ride through almost trafficless streets. I stood in front of two big bronze doors and waited alone in the sunlight. I knocked. Then I knocked again. The sound of my knock was very tinny, almost comic, against the heavy tonnage of the doors. No one answered. Soon a young man walked by. Early 20s, tight black t-shirt, tight black jeans, earrings up and down the lobes of his ears, a ring in his eyebrow, black spiky hair, sideburns shaved to points on the curve of his jaw. There were tattoos on the top of his arms, which disappeared under his t-shirt. He looked like a heavy metal rocker. We waited quietly, looking like loiterers. He looked at me and then looked away. I looked at my watch and I said, "Well, I guess they're not open yet." He nodded and said, "I'm early." I said, "Do you have an appointment here this morning?" He said, "Yes, I'm going to see the Pope." Now I noticed that suspended on his chest was a silver crucifix about 4 or 5 inches long. It was hanging from a rough leather chain. He was from Canada, he told me. He wrote rock music. He loved John Paul. He was in Rome for work, and he asked his bishop in Canada if he could see the Pope. I told him I'd done pretty much the same. Little by little, more people appeared. A hearty, middle-aged man with an Australian accent in a black suit with his wife and teenage children. He looked like the richest Catholic in Sydney. Then a Polish family came. The children were in full traditional costume with blonde hair and big bows, 5 children in old Polish dress, and their parents in modern dress. More people arrived. Soon there were more than a dozen of us. Suddenly, silently, the great doors opened, and we were gestured in by a man in a gray janitor's uniform, and hustled up the stairs, past Swiss guards, up marble stairs to the right, and more marble stairs to the left, then a landing with great marble halls, then up another floor of marble stairs until we were ushered into a big room of white-gray marble with big windows and big brown doors. Inside, there were a few more people, groups of people, waiting. In all, there were about 30 of us. We stood lining the room against the walls. There was excited chatter and soft laughter. I had stuck with my heavy metal Canadian, and the Australians had stuck with us. The Canadian looked at me at one point and said, "What do we do when we meet him? How do you meet the Pope?" It hadn't occurred to me to think about this, and so I shook my head and said, like an idiot American, "I think you shake his hand." He said, "You do? I thought you, like, kiss it or bow." I said, "I don't know," and I turned to ask the Australian man. Suddenly, there was silence, as if an unheard signal had been given, and we turned our heads and looked in the same direction towards the doors in the corner. They opened, and the Pope shuffled in. He was both massive and frail. He was full and bent. He was like frail marble. He walked slowly with a cane. The room burst into applause. A little group of dark-haired young nuns in blue over to the left spontaneously began to sing. They were so happy to see him, they were shouting out song, and he stopped still in front of them. His head went back a little, and he took his cane and he shook it toward them comically, and he said, in a baritone that filled the room, "Philippines." And the Filipino nuns exploded in joy, and some of them bent to their knees as he passed. Now he looked at another little group, and he shook his cane again. It was quite comic, and he said, "Brazil." And the Brazilians applauded, and they started to cry. And the Pope walked on, shuffling more quickly now, and then he walks by an extraordinary-looking young man. He had coal-black hair, thick and cut so that it was standing sort of straight up. It looked like Pentecost hair. He was slim, Asian. He was dressed like a seminarian. He was looking dreamily, happily. His hands were together in the attitude of prayer. And the Pope stopped, turned, and held his cane toward him. And the Pope said, "China." And the young man, as if slain, slid to his knees, bent toward the floor, and went to kiss the Pope's shoe. And the Pope caught him in an embrace as if to say, "No, I am not your hero. You are my hero." And from nowhere, absolutely nowhere, came to me an electric charge of thought. And I thought, I think I have just witnessed a future saint embrace a future Cardinal of Beijing. My eyes filled with tears. The Pope proceeded down the line. As he came closer, I tried to think of what to say, of all he meant to me, but it was too exciting. There is no right thing to say when you meet a saint in the flesh, when you meet a giant who wants to shake your hand and keep going. And suddenly he was inches from me to my left, and I just wanted to touch him. He came closer, and his frozen face was before me. One eye was bigger than the other, and it was tearing. I touched his left hand with my hands. When later I thought of his face, I would think of the scene near the end of the Tom Hanks movie Castaway, when he is floating on his raft at sea, and a giant whale rises from the deep and looks at him with an ancient eye. I sort of curtsy-bowed, like an awkward person, and then as I held his hand, I leaned forward and kissed his thick old knuckles. I think I said, "Papa," or "Hello, Papa." He looked at me, and he pressed into my hand a soft brown plastic envelope. It was 2 inches square, and it bore an imprint of the papal seal. When I opened it later, I saw there was an inexpensive white plastic rosary beads, bearing a silver Christ on the cross, his body broken and ungainly. It's the Christ the Pope carries at the top of his crozier, his long silver staff, when he enters the world each day. I still have the picture of our meeting. I never saw anyone take the picture. I was surprised to receive it in the mail from the Cardinal's office. I look transported, and John Paul looks serious. The last person on our line was the Canadian heavy metal rocker. When the Pope came up to him, the young man bowed and kissed his hand. The young man said, "I have written music for you." And he showed the Pope a sheet of music, beautifully hand-drawn, and it had a title like "A Song for John Paul II. The Pope looked at it and said, "You wrote?" And the rocker, rockin', said, "Yes, for you." The Pope took it. He walked a few feet away to where there was a big brown table, and he signed the sheet music in a big flourish, "Johannes Paulus II." He came back, and he gave it to the rocker, and then he walked on and out of the room. There was silence until it was broken softly by my rocker. He said, "This is the greatest moment of my life." And I was wordless, because it is a great honor to be present at the greatest moment in anyone's life. And then we were ushered out. Some people were weeping and some were laughing. I was just lighter than air. I went into the streets of Rome, hailed a cab, told the driver the name of my hotel, and I was so excited I left my eyeglasses behind me on the seat. But I remembered those rosary beads. Right now they are in my purse in the next room. A good thing happened with that rosary. For a year I kept it and showed it to people, and I thought to frame it with the picture of the Pope. And then one day, in the middle of trouble in my life, I did with it what those who give you such things hope for you to do. I said a rosary, and then another. But before that happened, I had to be sort of knocked on the head with information I'd not been receiving, or perhaps been avoiding. It was the summer of 2002. I was going through a trial in my life, or rather a series of serious challenges. When troubles come, as Shakespeare said, they come not as single spies, but in full battalions. I was entertaining an army. There were family pressures, work problems, frustrations of all sorts. The world had blown up 10 months before on 9/11, and someone I loved was ill. I felt that all of these things might capsize me. Always before, I had sailed without sinking in whatever seas, and I had always been able to steady my little boat. I had never before felt that a thing might capsize my life. During that time, of course, I often thought of the Pope and of how he felt each morning, waking up to a day in which he might never, ever feel truly well. At this time, a close friend sent me a videotape about how to say the rosary. On its plastic cover was a picture of small blue and gray pebbles. They shined as if they were underwater. I put the tape in its cover on the top of the TV set in my bedroom, and I'd walk by and see it most days, and I'd notice and think, pretty pebbles. I had a friend who often said rosary novenas. That is, every day he said the rosary, and with a specific cause and intent in mind, which he talked to God about. He took great joy in saying the rosary. I don't think I knew an adult who did that every day, and with joy. But then I remembered a friend, a mother of one of the kids at my son's grade school, who had told me years earlier that she said a rosary every day while on the treadmill. I found that image comic. She was a glamorous and socially active young lady, and I didn't know she was religious at all. I asked her what she got from saying the rosary each day. She sort of looked away for a moment, and then she looked back at me and she said, "All I can tell you is, if I say a rosary, that day works. And if I don't, nothing works." This stayed in my mind. My friend, the man who was saying the rosary novenas, inspired me. I wanted to say one, too. He gave me a book on the rosary to help jumpstart me. It was called Rosary: Mysteries, Meditations, and the Telling of the Beads by Kevin Orlin Johnson, a writer of depth and ease whose subject is Catholic belief and tradition. I opened the book and I read it quickly over a few days. It explained what saying the rosary is, how it starts with rosary beads, a circlet of beads punctuated with larger beads or with holy medals in a sort of necklace arrangement, usually with a shorter string of beads attached to it, ending in a cross or crucifix. No one has to have a rosary, no one has to say the rosary, but, quote, "for at least a dozen centuries, most people in the church have owned a rosary in one form or another," unquote. They are not for ornament, but for praying. They don't have any power in themselves. Quote, "Rosary beads are only a way of counting repetitions of vocal prayers, so you have to do something with them before you get any good out of them." But the repetitions, simple prayers repeated, aren't the point of the devotion either. These vocal prayers are, quote, "an aid to meditative prayer, to raising your mind and heart to God by meditating on the life of Jesus and Mary. These meditations are what constitute the rosary." Well, that was clear enough. I liked reading this. Quote, "The immense spiritual, emotional, and even intellectual benefits of meditative prayer are the reason that so many millions of people pray the rosary each day. The rosary works. The graces drawn down by this form of meditative prayer answer all petitions and supply all necessities," unquote. Well, I had plenty of petitions and needs. All of this was interesting, but for some reason, the part that was most striking to me was the explanation of the history of the rosary that came from Johnson. The rosary started and began as a tradition not because the church hierarchy invented it, they didn't, or ordained it, they didn't, and not because priests advised it. It was really a people's prayer. Lay members of the church came up with it, loved it, and spread it. In the first centuries after Christ, a number of those who had heard his word and been converted to follow him retreated to the wilderness, turning the center of their lives to prayer. They would listen to their heartbeats and silently say, as they breathed in, Jesus Christ, Son of God. As they breathed out, they would silently say, Have mercy on us. Here's Kevin Orland Johnson again, quote, By repeating this or some similar prayer over and over again, they would relax their own wills, absorb themselves in this act of merciful prayer for all mankind, and become immersed in an awareness of the presence of God. The point was not to empty themselves out, but to open themselves up to God's grace. So this, the saying of what came to be known as the Jesus Prayer, is how the Rosary in effect began. But not every Christian could live like a mystic monk in the desert. Others are called to do other work, to build families and create community and embrace professions. And they wanted to take up this form of prayer too. So they began to say a certain number of vocal prayers each day before or after they went to work and went into the cares of the day. And these Christians began to count their prayers and mark them off with pebbles after each was done. This is Kevin Orland Johnson on an early Christian mystic named Paul the Hermit. Quote, Paul would pick up 300 pebbles every morning and put them in his pocket. Whatever Paul wore, it evidently had pockets. And he would throw one away each time he had repeated his prayer. As the centuries rolled on, monks and nuns continued to pray in this way, even when they lived in large communities, which, being usually in the wilderness, had plenty of pebbles available. Unquote. And that was how they counted the prayers they'd vowed to say. Now, this was interesting to me. A prayer itself seems so special, and yet a pebble is so common and undistinguished. And yet you can build, in effect, these common things together into something very special and even towering. So, in my time of challenge, I was thinking about pebbles. The pebbles on the cover of the videotape, the pebbles in the Kevin Orland Johnson book, the pebbles I saw on Jones Beach when I went out there that summer to see old friends. I thought a lot. I just didn't say any rosaries. I find this to be true of my spiritual life, and maybe it applies to some degree to you as well. I think about things more than I do them. I ponder what seems to be their goodness more than I perform them, as if my thoughts alone were enough. But a thought alone isn't quite enough. It's an impulse. It's not a commitment. It's a passing thing that doesn't take root unless you plant it and make it grow. So I just thought about all this, and I was very glad other people were saying rosary, and I would always ask them when I met them to say a prayer for me. Meanwhile, the problems that I was having were growing more urgent, and I would talk to God about them, but I didn't say the rosary. And then I feel I got told to say a rosary. This is what happened. I got up one sunny morning and I did what I always do. I went to the kitchen and I made coffee in a white plastic Braun coffee maker. I don't have a cup of coffee in the morning. I have a glass of coffee because it's bigger. I use one of those sort of heavy, unbreakable tumblers that you get at a hardware store or a department store. They're made by the Dorelex company. So, every morning I pour the coffee into the tumbler and then I add milk and I go do whatever I'm doing. So that morning, as I dreamily poured the coffee, I was thinking that I ought to pray more. I ought to say a morning prayer. I ought to... Suddenly there was an explosion. Kaboom! It was really loud. I was so surprised I couldn't even register what had happened. The glass I was pouring the coffee into no longer existed. It had exploded into little pieces that were scattered now all over the floor, all over the counter, all the way over the sink. I just stood there with a Braun coffee pot in my hand. What was that? Called my son from his bedroom. And I said, my glass of coffee exploded. He said, it sounded like a piggy bank exploded. I put down the coffee pot. And I looked at the mess. There was coffee all over, all the way up the cupboard, on the refrigerator, on the ceiling. There was coffee all over the front of my T-shirt. And this is the thing. My first thought was that the coffee must have been unusually hot, and maybe the tumbler had a crack, and it just sort of received the heat of the coffee in the wrong way and broke apart. But the coffee wasn't hot. This was another strange thing. I could feel it on my body. The front of my t-shirt was soaked with the coffee, and it was lukewarm. In fact, when it sort of exploded all over me, it felt good. It felt warming. And what happened didn't strike me as upsetting. It felt kind of peaceful. This was all perplexing, but not disturbing. It seemed interesting, like a puzzle. I picked up a piece of glass. It was about an eighth of an inch long and an eighth of an inch wide. I picked up another and then another, and then for no reason, I picked up all of them, and there were hundreds, and they were all over the room. But they were all small and smooth. They weren't jagged. None of them was big. They were all pretty much the same size, except for a few that sort of held together. You could roll them in your hand, and I did roll them in my hand. And they were smooth as pebbles. So I gathered them up, and I put them in a paper towel, and then I rinsed them off in the sink, in the towel, and I put them on the windowsill to dry. Then I put them in a pretty crystal wine glass. As I write this, they are on the windowsill just beyond my computer. You wonder why I kept them. The reason is, I don't think it was a weak or cracked glass. I feel that it was God talking to me. I think he was saying, pebbles. I think he was saying, I'm trying to get your attention here. I think he was saying, there is explosive power in the pebbles. I think he was saying, there is explosive power in what appear to be mere pebbles. There is explosive power in the rosary, and I want you to know this. I don't know how long it took me to figure this all out, but I think it was pretty quick. I remember thinking when I realized the coffee all over my shirt and me was warm and not hot and felt good and not burning, I remember thinking, this feels like a little miracle. Well, I suppose you know where this is going. I began to say the rosary, and for a while I did it every day. I had a few rosaries because I'd bought them over the years because I think they're so very pretty. I just didn't use them. And now suddenly I was using them, and I found out what my friend had told me, the one who said it every morning on her treadmill. Everything turned out fine when I said those prayers. I also said a rosary novena, and here is a stupid thing. I can't remember exactly what I was asking for, but I must have asked for a lot because I got a lot. What I got was not so much gifts and wishes come true, but a feeling of peace. I got peace itself, actually. And when you have peace, you can be strong. And when you are strong, you can get through what you have to get through. And not with exhaustion and frown marks and slumped shoulders, but with relative happiness and humor and sometimes even gaiety. I loved saying my rosary. I attempted once to do it with a friend who tried every day to say the rosary while walking along the streets of Manhattan. This struck me as a very happy thing to do, but when we did it, I was distracted by the fact that we perhaps looked mildly insane. We'd walk along saying our prayers, and it seemed obvious that we looked like two ladies with their heads down mumbling to themselves. Sometimes I tried it on my own, meaning to walk along and pray silently. But I was like Aunt Jane Jane. Sometimes I started praying out loud, and then I was a lady mumbling to herself. In the spring of 2003, I had dinner with the woman who walks along the streets of Manhattan saying the rosary, and she told me, actually, that technology had just recently made everything easier. What do you mean? I said. She said, you know, with those cell phones and earpieces, half the people on the sidewalks of New York now look like they're walking along talking to themselves. She said, I fit right in. What I learned to love most was saying the rosary on the subway when I was going into Manhattan from Brooklyn. I would bring the rosary the Pope had given me because it was the only one that I had in a little case, so I'd throw the case in my pocket and jump on the number 4 or the number 5 going uptown. All of the amazing and highly individualized people down there in the subway would be going about their business and talking to one another and sometimes arguing with one another, and I'd just be sitting there or standing there, saying my rosary and praying for all of us and everyone. And wherever I went, I felt there was peace. This was surprising. Once I was on the subway going downtown, going home for some meeting in the city, and it was crowded and it was tense for some reason, I don't remember why. Maybe we'd been caught between stops. And a big, tall, strong woman with a Jamaican accent, who appeared to be high on drugs, got into a fight with a man whose block she threatened to knock off. I watched. I liked her. She seemed strong and intelligent and passionate, but she was pushing the guy around verbally, and she was all the more insistent and nearing the edge of rage, I think, because she experienced herself to be the person who was being pushed around. I continued to say my prayers, but I directed them in my mind toward the woman, and in time she calmed down, with the help of the intervention of a diplomatic passenger, and fisticuffs were averted. Once, a creepy man was bothering a young woman who was being polite to him, but he was scaring her. So I prayed on him, and he got off at the next stop. Obviously, this has nothing to do with my power, because I don't have power. But all prayers are a request, one way or another. At the very least, they are, quote, please hear me, unquote. And when you turn them to peace, there's a greater chance peace is going to break out. Anyway, the creepy guy got off at the next stop. The person I had cared about who was ill entered the process of being healed and is now healed, which is very beautiful to see. Naturally, this is so amazing about human beings, and I am naturally embarrassed to tell you this part. I kept saying the rosary for about a year or two or maybe three, and then I stopped and went on to other things. This is like being on a beautiful vitamin regimen that makes you completely healthy and happy. And then you tell all your friends and advise them to do it. And then you stop taking the vitamins yourself. We are perverse. But actually, I am thinking that this chapter might remind me of what I know and turn me around. I should get back to the Pope, to John Paul, because he had put in my hand the rosary beads I used on the subway, and I began to associate him with saying the rosary. And yet, still, it was startling to me when he did something in the 24th year of his reign that struck others as wholly off the point, and struck me as wholly on the point and to the point. John Paul changed the rosary. This was kind of an amazing decision. No one could remember the last time a pope changed how the rosary is said. It would have been hundreds of years. It could have been a millennium. No one knows. But here it was, October 2002, and John Paul II decided to add to the litany of the rosary what he called the luminous mysteries. Now, as I said earlier, the point and purpose of the rosary is not to recite rote prayers, but to repeat prayers you know by heart, the Hail Mary, the Lord's Prayer, as you contemplate a mystery of Christianity, a mystery in this context being an important event whose entire meaning you won't fully understand in this world. For roughly 900 years, there have been three groups of mysteries included in the rosary: the joyous mysteries, that's Christ entering the world, the sorrowful mysteries, that's Christ being abused and put to death, and the glorious mysteries, that's Christ and heaven. What John Paul did was to add a new set of mysteries, the luminous mysteries, which encompassed Christ's ministry and teachings. The most startling thing about the Pope's announcement was that the new mysteries didn't seem so much an addition to a tradition as the logical filling of a gap. The new mysteries seemed like something that might have originally been part of the rosary, but had somehow been lost along the way. The joyful mysteries, for instance, end with Christ being found at age 12 in the temple where he'd been teaching the elders. The sorrowful mysteries start with Christ suffering in Gethsemane the night before his death. It was odd to contemplate the joyfuls one day and jump on the next day to the sorrowfuls with nothing in between. It really felt like something was missing, and that would be the luminous mysteries, which offer for contemplation what Christ did and said as an adult. That's what the Pope added. So it seemed organic and natural. But why did John Paul, in effect, rewrite the rosary after it had existed in codified form for hundreds of years? Father C.J. McCloskey of Washington's Catholic Information Center told me when I called to ask him why the Pope would do such an amazing thing. He said he is making a statement at the end of his life about what's important to him. Father McCloskey said, by adding these mysteries, he is saying, this is another invitation to look closely at the life of Christ, to contemplate and to meditate. I said, you mean to think? And he said, not to think, to let the life of Christ sink into you. Arthur J. Hughes, a history professor at St. Francis College of Brooklyn, talked to me about the luminous mysteries. He spoke with excitement even a year after they were introduced. He said, John Paul gave us the mysteries that belong to us, to the people, to the life we live. The host, the wedding at Cana, this is the life of the people. Not solely the life of Christ, but the life of the people. He said, this Pope's a real thinker, and he's the best we've had in my lifetime. The timing of the Pope's decision and announcement seemed interesting. The Rosary is, by long tradition, a prayer for peace in the world. In the church-sanctioned Visitations of Mary, there have been more reported visions in the past 150 years than in all the previous centuries combined. The Blessed Mother has asked in almost all cases that the Rosary be said for peace. And the day he made the announcement, the Pope dedicated the entire coming year to the Rosary. He did it in a way that was embracing of other Christian traditions, asserting that the Rosary is, quote, Christocentric, a way of thinking about Jesus through and with the mother who gave him life and witnessed his life. This was a not too subtle invitation to all Christians to take a new look at the old devotion, one that some Protestants have seen as unhappily Mary-centric in the past. In his announcement, John Paul used the words luminous or light 29 times. Which reminded me, of course, of the prophecies of St. Malachy, the mystic of the Middle Ages, who had named each future pope with a phrase, and who referred to John Paul's pontificate with the words, of the labors of the sun, which is, of course, the most luminous star and the bringer of light to the world. I want here to say a few words, too, about the difficulty of contemplation, which is something I've always wrestled with and continue to. The Pope said in his letter that he sensed a great hunger in the world for meditation, and he made clear he meant to help feed it, in part, with the offering of the new mysteries. When I was a new rosary sayer, I was struck by the difficulties of meditating and contemplating, and I found some helpful counsel in the Pope's letter. I did not know how to meditate when I began saying the rosary, so I'd just begin by imagining particular scenes in my mind. In the first Joyful Mysteries, for instance, the angel Gabriel comes to a girl of perhaps 14 or 16 and announces that she is to become the Mother of God. She says, more or less in response, yes, what the Lord wants is what should be done. This scene is described in St. Luke's Gospel, so I'd try to imagine it. But then the phone would ring, and I would listen to the message coming on, or an ambulance would come by, and suddenly I'd find myself daydreaming. Then I'd be wondering why Mary is never reported to have fallen down and fainted or run away when an angel walked into her garden and started talking to her. Then I'd start thinking, well, maybe she'd been seeing angels for years. Maybe she thought they were her playmates when she was a child. Maybe they were commonplace to her. Maybe that's part of the reason she seems to have moved through life with unbroken serenity. The third joyful mystery is the birth of Christ in a manger. It's not hard to imagine this. It's hard to control one's imaginings. You'd imagine the trek to the manger, the sounds coming from the eating area of the inn the Holy Family had just passed, a bawdy joke and laughter as they trudged by. And then you start to wonder, was Mary in pain? Did she weep him into the world? She was barely more than a child herself, with a young husband, no help, just the two of them in the cold in a hut on a hill. And when the child was born, did he cry aloud with a great wail? Did the cry enter the universe? Did it become a sound wave of unusual or significant density? Is it still out there radiating its way out into the stars? Did the Voyager 2 bump into it, and did it jostle its cameras and change what it saw? Did someone unrecorded by history see a light in the hut on the hill the night Christ was born and come to help Mary and Joseph? Maybe there was an old woman with moles and wens and a sharply bent nose, a woman almost comically ugly like a witch in a child's Halloween book. Maybe she lived in isolation and never left her own little hovel. But maybe that night she felt called to be helpful and to assist, tugged by some wonder that pierced her estrangement. Maybe she helped with the birth. Maybe hers was the first face he saw. Maybe her outer appearance was an expression of the inner wounds he had come to heal. Maybe she helped wrap him in rags. Maybe she bent down and breathed him in, her face bathed by the mist of a rough birth on a frosty night. Maybe then she returned home and she was beautiful. But no one knew because she never left her hut again. Even she didn't know she'd been made lovely. No, maybe she went out the next day, the first time she'd gone out in the day in 30 years. And maybe she went by a booth in the market, and she saw a looking glass, and she was stunned, and she saw herself. You see the problem. I found it very difficult to concentrate on what we believe we know. I still do. I have wondered if we don't, so many of us, enjoy making amusing filigrees around the truth, not to enhance it necessarily, but in a way almost to avoid it. I concentrate on the first sorrowful mystery, Christ in the night in the Garden of Gethsemane. He was suffering in deep anguish. Maybe he was thinking that in spite of the pain to which he was about to be subjected, in spite of his self-sacrifice, the world was going to continue to be a miserable place. Maybe the evil one sneaked into his mind and taunted him with a film of the future. Thomas More being put to death as a Christian by Christians, Edmund Campion and John Fisher the same, the Inquisition, the Holocaust, cardinals of the church who would be incapable of showing compassion for the families of children abused by priests. Maybe all of that is what made him sweat blood. Also, he must have loved life. He must have been in love with life on earth. What does that tell us? He must have wanted to grow old. He knew of heaven, and yet he wanted to stay here. What did he love? Did he love the taste of bread, the smell of it, the sound of animals on the hills? What was it? He must have liked being a carpenter's apprentice. Woodwork is satisfying. You can see the results of your labor. You can touch it and feel its smooth finish. Maybe when he was a young carpenter, Christ made a chair once. Maybe no one knows it, but a chair made by Christ is in the Museum of Natural History in Manhattan right now, in a little case with a card that says on front, Child's Chair, circa 100 BCE. Maybe there's a guard in the museum who's in love with a girl on the third floor. Maybe they met in front of the case. Maybe you see where I am. I am daydreaming, not meditating. But here was the Pope in the letter on the rosary. He said, to announce each mystery as you begin to pray, to focus on it, is to open up a scenario. The words you are saying direct the imagination and the mind toward a particular episode. In Catholic spirituality, visual and imaginative elements help in concentrating the mind. The Pope cautioned that the process is nourished by silence. Yes, that is certainly true. He said, one drawback of a society dominated by technology and the mass media is the fact that silence becomes increasingly difficult to achieve. Don't I know it? He said, you must try to both be silent and find a quiet place to let thoughts come in and sit down. So, try not to be near the phone and the siren. Open your mind to the images and words with which you are feeding it. Let your imagination go, as long as where it goes is a good place to be. This seemed not only like good advice, but advice I especially needed. All right, here. This is just a story. This is unconnected, but to me connected, because at the moment I can't stop thinking about Christ and his desire to live and what must have been his great love of life on earth. What I think of lately when I think about this is the composer and performer Warren Zevon. Like the Pope, he was a philosopher, though I don't imagine he would have thought of himself that way. He said something very true about life on earth, though, and it was worth more than its weight in gold and diamonds. When he was dying of lung cancer in the autumn of 2002, Zevon did a famous hour-long interview with David Letterman. Letterman asked him, "From your perspective now, do you know something about life and death that maybe I don't know?" And Zevon famously replied, "I know how much you're supposed to enjoy every sandwich." He knew how wonderful and delicious the smallest parts of daily life are. He knew how wonderful and delicious a day in your life or an hour of that day or this minute really is. We're lucky to be here. And now when I think of friends and family and those I love or those I'm just getting to know, I think, he knows how good the sandwich is, or she doesn't know how good the sandwich is yet. But it's good to know, and it's more fun, too.